This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is sponsored by Penguin Teen. From number one New York Times bestselling author Sabaa Tahir comes a brilliant, unforgettable, and heart-wrenching contemporary YA novel about family and forgiveness, love and loss, and a sweeping story that crosses generations and continents. Lahore, Pakistan, then. Misbah is a dreamer and storyteller, newly married to Tawfiq in an arranged match. After their young life is shaken by tragedy, they come to the United States and open Cloud's Rest Inn Motel, hoping for a new start. Juniper, California, now. Salahuddin and Noor are more than best friends. They are family. Growing up as outcasts in the small desert town of Juniper, California, they understand each other the way no one else does, until the fight which destroys their bond with the swift fury of a star exploding. Now, Sal scrambles to run the family motel, and Noor walks a harrowing tightrope, working at her wrathful uncle's liquor store while hiding the fact that she's applying to college so she can escape Juniper forever. When Sal's attempts to save the motel spiral out of control, he and Noor must ask themselves what friendship is worth and what it takes to defeat the monsters in their past and the ones in their midst. From one of the most cherished and best-selling young adult authors comes a breathtaking novel about young love, old regrets, and forgiveness, one that's both tragic and poignant in its tender ferocity. And it's already received 6-starred reviews. That is All My Rage by Sabaa Tahir. And thanks so much to Penguin Teen for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to Hey YA. From great new books to favorite classic reads, from news stories to the latest in on-screen adaptations, Hey YA is here to elevate the exciting world of young adult lit. Hey YA is a book riot podcast hosted by Erica Ezzafetti and me, Tirza Price. We are recording on February 24th, 2022. And today we're going to be taking a slightly different approach to our normal format. And we're going to address an elephant in the room right now, which is censorship. And so this isn't going to be like a normal episode where we talk about books mostly and sort of issues as a secondary talking point, because this is a pretty big and complicated topic. And chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you're aware of what's going on in the broad sense. But today, Erica and I want to dig in a little bit deeper. So hello, Erica. Are you ready for this?
Oh my God, Tears, I guess. I mean, yes, in short, yes. Because it's like, as depressing and infuriating as it is, it definitely needs to be, you know, dived into and explored more.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, it's like, I just, even typing up the show notes and kind of collecting some thoughts for this, like, I was getting angry, but like, underneath the anger, I'm weary.
Yeah.
I'm so weary of having to like devote so much mental space and energy to just being like, let's talk about this like very basic and boring censorship issue. Because that's the thing. Like, I find this so boring because it's always the same.
Yeah.
And but like, it's important. We have to keep showing up. We have to keep fighting. And like, that's kind of the point, is like the opposition wants us to get tired. Mm-hmm. So we stop fighting. So we can't.
I think it's interesting how they have this like Energizer Bunny level of stamina to be with this. Like, as you said, it's boring. It's like, y'all are still at this still. How long has it been? And you're still doing this. And it's interesting how the method for this, the end goal, the methods haven't changed that much throughout history. And the end goal being, you know, white supremacy and controlling the narrative, which the narrative is white supremacy. So yeah. They've been trying to maintain control of the narrative in interest of white supremacy for hundreds of years now, at least in the United States. But I think it's interesting how the methods for doing so, like I said a second ago, are the same, which is, again, controlling the narrative and inflicting violence.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like they are the same, but at the same time, they're getting more sophisticated, which I think is something that we want to talk about, too.
Because that's true.
I don't think that a lot of people realize that a lot of these censorship challenges are coming from a place of like deep organization within certain conservative groups where they are well funded. And that sounds so conspiracy theory like, but it's true. Like, you know, there's reporting that indicates just that. So that's scary, you know? Like, they've gotten more sophisticated.
Yeah.
It's like the same old boring, I was about to swear, same old boring stuff, but it's like next level insidious.
Yeah. I think the insidiousness of it has come as a result of, like, you can't outwardly be racist. Or, I mean, some people are. They don't care about being judged for being racist. But I feel like a lot of racism, sexism, homophobia, all those isms and phobias, I feel like they've become, they've been pushed, you know, kind of underneath, and it's been relegated to like subtext and microaggressions and sometimes some very real actual physical aggression and harm and death. But I feel like as far as like when people talk about it, when politicians address it, they are more sophisticated because it's not accepted. It's not acceptable to be an outright bigot.
Yeah.
Well, and then again,
there's a higher social cost for it these days.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like you see some of it coming out, and well, then I think that's part of the thing is like they want us to believe that like, oh, what they're saying isn't racist. Mm-hmm. They don't want you to call them out and be like, well, that's transphobic, that's racist, because then, you know, it makes them look bad. So if they can kind of cast it in a different light and be like, oh no, where it's about protecting our children, mm-hmm. it's about making sure that our children don't feel ashamed for the past, then it's like, oh, then all of a sudden there's something new to debate when there's really not, you know?
No, exactly. And I think it's important for people to not separate the present from the past. Like, I think a lot of us think of like the 50s and before that as being like very distant times in terms of like social ideologies and policies and civil rights and stuff, but they're not. And I think to think of them as being separate from our present day is a form of privilege because, mm-hmm. you know, well, for instance, me being Black, I feel like I've mentioned I'm Black every episode. I just realized that. But yes, I am Black, quite Black. So I grew up being warned about discrimination in various ways, sometimes jokingly, sometimes not so jokingly. And I know a lot of other Black Americans have that experience. So I say it's a privilege for some people to act like, you know, the Jim Crow South was a long time ago and therefore for distant from our present reality, because for other people it's not that distant. Like, mm-hmm. my grandparents grew up with a lot more discrimination in the American South, so the warnings and stuff that I got from them was not just some, you know, antiquated, you know, school book lesson, but rather yeah. their lived experiences. I recently did like a very mild like genealogy search. And I saw that my grandfather, my maternal grandfather's mom or his grandmother was a slave. So I'm like, it's not that far, honestly.
No.
So to, you know, to think of times where what we were just talking about, like subjugation, you know, outright physical terror are that far from now is a privilege. I think people need to think of those times as being, you know, just around the corner. I feel like that can kind of just, you know, reframe things.
Yeah. And I think like to sort of piggyback off of that and tie this into, you know, books and book riot, we get like a lot of, you know, critique and criticism and like not just like, you know, me personally, but I've seen this like across the board with like a lot of writers that Book Riot and like whatever we do, whether it's newsletters, podcasts, like content, social media, which is like, why are you talking politics? Like, I read books to escape politics. And like what you're saying is that like for some of us, we can't just escape it. And if you can escape like the horribleness of the world in a good book, that is like a level of privilege. And like, obviously, you know, that's not anything that is by your own virtue or doing. Yeah. But I do think that we need to be aware of that. And also just, you know, because if we're aware of our privilege, we're aware of the power that we have in certain spaces to speak up. And I think that especially ties into when you have all of these books that are largely about and by marginalized people that are being challenged, you know, who is losing out? Like, you and I can always go buy these books because we're adults with adult money. Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids have, you know, access to public libraries or parents who can buy books. They have other ways of getting books. But for so many children and teens, like the only way they get books is in their school libraries. So what happens when all of these diverse, essential books disappear? Like their world shrinks down into a very white and limited perspective. Mm-hmm. And that makes me angry. So yes, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a lot of nervous laughing because I'm angry and I don't want to like explode into swearing. But yeah, this is just like, it's a big thing that's happening right now. And we do kind of want to keep this kind of like beyond like, oh, these are the books that are being challenged. Mm-hmm. And we want to dig into, you know, some of the things that are going on behind the scenes that a lot of people might not be thinking about when it comes to banned books. But then also like some solutions and areas of resistance and all that fun stuff. So hopefully you come away from this not feeling so much as angry as empowered, although a bit of anger can empower you and to go a long way.
Mm, yes. Empowering anger. I like that. For real.
All right. Do you want to give us our first sponsor and then we can dive in?
For sure. This episode is sponsored by The Lost Dreamer by Liz Huerta with Fierce Reads. A stunning novel inspired by ancient Mesoamerica, this gripping debut introduces us to a lineage of seers defiantly resisting the shifting patriarchal state that would see them destroyed. Perfect for fans of Tomi Adeyemi and Sabaa Tahir. With a detailed, supernaturally charged setting and topical themes of patriarchal power and female strength, The Lost Dreamer brings an ancient world to life, mirroring the challenges of our modern one. This book is getting lots of buzz. Entertainment Weekly called it spring's buzziest fantasy debut, and BuzzFeed says its glorious world-building and powerful leads make this a can't-miss read. Thanks again to The Lost Dreamer by Liz Huerta with Fierce Reads for sponsoring this episode.
All right. So, where to dive in? Let's just do kind of like a quick over, you know, like a broad overlook of what's happening right now, because I think a lot of people are, I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you know that this is probably going on. But if you don't know a lot about what's going on, in summary, the American Library Association Office of Intellectual Freedom is saying that there are an unprecedented number of book challenges sweeping the country right now. I feel like obviously challenges happen all the time. There's definitely obviously been a huge spike in them. But for me, like the moment where I was like, WTF, sort of like the changing moment was when a Texas state representative came up with this list of 850 books that he wanted schools and libraries to look into and investigate. And basically, they were books that he felt might make students feel uncomfortable on the basis of, you know, race, sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason that felt different, not just because of like the huge number of books, like 850 books is a lot of books.
Ridiculous.
That's like more books than I read in like 4 years. That's a lot of books. But, you know, it's just, it was a Texas state representative who came up with this list and he was asking these school libraries to investigate. And that in and of itself was like a little bit unusual, like not wholly unprecedented, but a bit unusual. So, you know, that happened at the end of October. And it really like just kind of you know, got a lot of buzz and created this cascade of challenges that really, I think what it was meant to do was just like put this topic in the national news and get a lot of people who might not be paying attention to books in schools all of a sudden like angry and stirred up to like, you know, stoke the flames. So, you know, then, you know, there just have been so many challenges. They touch like every single state in the country. And in a lot of cases, there have been a lot of local state governments wanting to make decisions about books in schools. And what's really alarming is that the argument has shifted from like, you know, are these books appropriate in schools to, well, shouldn't parents have a say in what their children read in schools? Parents ought to have a choice. And it's like, yeah, it's called, you know, you elect somebody to the school board. And then you like hire administrators who hire teachers who are all professionally trained in these subjects. Like that is how society is supposed to work. So, but like now we're seeing lots of challenges to this. So that, I mean, very broadly is what's happening right now.
Excellent summary, first off. But it's interesting because there was a recent story that we released at Book Riot that was showing that only 27% of people in Texas trust politicians' judgment of school books.
Oof.
So
that's pretty low.
It's pretty low. The survey was conducted this month, this year. They surveyed about 1,200 registered voters, 33% were Democrat, 41% were Republican, 26 identified as neither, and they surveyed them on various topics concerning Texas politics, and that included book bans. So one of the questions was, how do you trust the judgment of elected state leaders in reviewing what books are controversial and should be removed from K through 12 schools? And like I said a second ago, 27% approved of them. So I feel like, as you said before, it's this huge list of 850 books that Matt Krause elected should be removed from schools and reviewed. It definitely seems like a ploy to get national, you know, attention on it and to, I think, overstate the... To overstate how many people want this to happen who are in Texas, for instance.
Yeah. And that's like a good point because it gets at one of our points that we want to make is like the issue of these challenges, like they take time away from people doing the work. Like 850 books, like I just said, like that's more books than I read in 4 years. Yeah. Like there's no way that even like one of the most like well-staffed library with like multiple experts in teen and children's literature can quickly review and evaluate 850 books. Like,
it's impossible.
I mean, if he doesn't know this, then like he knows what he's doing. It's like just throwing so much work onto libraries and librarians. And like, there have been a lot of great articles about like the cost of doing that. And how like it's unreasonable to put that work and that much effort for libraries and librarians to justify like what they've already purchased. Mm-hmm. And so, and like I've worked in public libraries. I've actually, you know, dealt firsthand with challenges. I've had to, you know, go to my director when we've received a challenge, justify why I bought a certain book that was being challenged for the collection. And it takes time.
Wow.
And so, yeah, because like you have to sit down, you have to, you know, look at the book if you haven't already read it, because, you know, I would buy books I'd not read, but, and every librarian does that, but you do so by, you know, adhering to your collection development policy, by looking at reviews, by reading about books, and that is how you, that's how you choose books. So you have to take this book, you have to evaluate it, you have to identify its target audience, you have to identify how it fits in with your collection, you have to identify how it fits within your collection development policies. Then you might have to pull like, oh, okay, this is, you know, here are some favorable reviews, like trade reviews, not just reader reviews, but like actual backed trade reviews. And here, like the awards the book has won, you have to justify the book. And then, you know, the director of the library will have to address any particular complaints. Like, there's a really great example that we posted on Book Riot of somebody in Texas challenging Gender Queer, which is the graphic novel about growing up non-binary. And they proclaimed that it's pornographic and pornography is against state law, so therefore it should be removed. And what this library director actually did was consulted with the city attorney, which is very good. That's doing the due diligence. Mm-hmm. And the city attorney was able to identify pornography, like, within the context of this challenge and prove that, like, no, this is not pornography in this context. And then you have to, like, write a letter explaining all of this. Usually that has to go before the library board or of trustees. You have to have this whole conversation, and then you make a decision, and then the director has to respond to the original complaint. So I feel like I just spent a lot of time talking about the process. Like, that is the process in a nutshell, with everything going smoothly. But that's what is happening right now, is that librarians and teachers have to spend more time on paperwork and justifying all of these purchases rather than just, like, relying on their training. And it's taking away from doing real important work that needs to be done in schools and libraries. And it just makes me angry. So,
yeah. And it's interesting that they have to prove. I feel like the people who are making the challenges should prove that the book is unsuitable, documented in, you know, because back to Matt Krause's 850 book list ban or whatever, there were some. Danica Ellis at Book Riot, she went through and analyzed the whole list, and some of the books he included on there were, like, part of a series, and he would list, like, the second or the third or something in the series, and it's like, okay, what about the first? So it was clear that you all are not reading these books. You're looking at what they're titled. You're looking at who authored them. Mm-hmm. And who authored them, they're usually Black or another racial minority. They're trans. They're queer. And you're just sticking with that. I feel like they should, the onus of responsibility of proving something should be on them. They should be writing letters.
Yeah, but, you know, if they write, "I want to challenge this book because I'm a racist," then they wouldn't be taken seriously.
Oh, okay. Good point, Tirza.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's their, yeah. And I think that's another important facet to this whole situation, which is, like, to me, it's a very obvious attack against marginalized folks, particularly Black authors. And I think that they are getting, like, not to play any oppression Olympics here, but I do feel like Black authors are getting more targeted than other racial minorities, just because a lot of these conversations are centering around critical race theory, which is so ridiculous because, you know, people are challenging any book by a Black author and they're citing the reason as critical race theory when the book is not about critical race theory at all. It's just, you know, these characters are Black, and why does that automatically constitute a political issue? It doesn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there's challenges against queer authors, trans authors. Erin Hahn, who's a YA author, who's a white, cis, straight woman, wrote, like, "Here are all of these things that I have written about." And she was like, "You know, I've written about queer couples. I've written about sex before marriage. I've written, like, about toxic, you know, church purity culture." Mm-hmm. "I've written about all of these things, but, like, my books have never been banned."
Yeah.
It's almost like it's not about the content or the books at all, which I think there is a grain of truth in that. Like, I do feel like, you know, this is an attack not necessarily on books, although certainly the books are the focus, but it's on people who have a different point of view than you. And that is what's scary, because I don't know about you, but I relied on books so much as a kid, mm-hmm. especially as somebody who, for a long time in my teen years, did not realize that I was queer. Once I sort of started to have those questions, the first thing I did was I went to YA books. And I can't imagine what I would have done if I hadn't had those books. So it's really alarming to me to think of a school library without any LGBTQ books at all. Like, my heart aches for the queer students in those schools, because there are queer students in those schools. Mm-hmm. There are.
I feel like, it's like, where do you even start? I feel like in response to, on the note of critical race theory, again, a lot of our listeners are going to be at least somewhat familiar with that ongoing issue, but critical race theory is something that's taught in like graduate school. I would say it's not even necessarily, well, I can't speak for every undergrad program, but it's something that you learn after high school, basically.
Yeah, you're not getting it in kindergarten.
No, you're not getting it in K through 12. Most likely, you're not. I mean, past grade 12, a lot of people might not even want to get into the thick of it, even people who are interested in, you know, anti-racist leanings, just because it's a, you know, a particular, like, learning path, you know. So I feel like, as we've been saying earlier in this episode, like, book bans are nothing new, censorship is not new, but I do wonder if the kind of amped up state book banning and censorship is in, I wonder if it is a, you know, direct result of the 2020 protests that came because of George Floyd's murder. I think that people saw the response that, like, everyone had to that. Things like Black Lives Matter and protests and stuff had been going on for years. Well, they've always been going on.
Yeah.
Since this country, you know, was started as the United States. But I think people who were skeptical of it, but when I say it, I mean police brutality, subjugation of people of color, specifically Black people, by authority figures, etc. People who were skeptical of it were, like, not skeptical at that point, because that it was on video. So mm-hmm. I think that really changed a lot of people's mind on issues like that. And it just, as we saw, it kind of just opened, like, people opened up. A lot of organizations and just people on social media who were not previously, you know, talking about it, were talking about it. My neighborhood. Yeah. Even now, still, there are, you know, Black Lives Matter signs in yards and stuff like that. And people who didn't go to protests were suddenly going to protests. So I feel like this amped up effort, I feel like it's in response to that. It's to counter that awareness that was suddenly turned on in, you know, May 2020, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think just having more widespread news coverage of the protests, and that really, you know, brought it into, like, the mainstream discussion for a lot of white Americans who had the privilege to kind of just tune out previously, and all of a sudden, like, it's in your face because it's on the news, it's what people are talking about, it's on social media, and that sort of visibility and awareness is really important. But I totally agree with you. I think that it's definitely in reaction to a lot of protests and a lot of people just speaking out and being like, no more, like, we're done, like, things have to change. Which is why I think, and I alluded to this earlier, I think what a lot of people need to understand is that, like, it's not just that, oh, books are getting more risque these days, and that's why people are challenging them. A lot of these challenges are a concerted effort by conservative-backed groups with deep pockets, you know, groups like Moms of Liberty, who are, like, faith-based parents' rights organization groups who are, like, literally organizing and educating other people on how to challenge books in their own communities. And that is alarming to me because, you know, that's organization that's, I don't know, like I said, it's insidious, it's intent, it's very full of intent. And it makes me very uneasy, especially because I also can't separate a lot of what's going on with, you know, what was just announced yesterday in Texas, which is Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, has directed Texas CPS to investigate trans kids as abuse cases. So basically any kid who is trans and who has adults in their lives who are supporting them, they can now be investigated as child abuse. And that is horrifying. And he's also ordered that, you know, people in schools report that, like they have to report that. And that, yeah, it's horrifying. I don't know what more to say. I was sick yesterday when I read the news. I wasn't surprised, but I was sick.
It's almost, I guess I shouldn't say, it's kind of almost unbelievable that that's even happening now. But again, I'll follow my own advice and not separate the past from the present, honestly. But it does take a moment. Like, sometimes news sounds like something out of a dystopian novel that I've read. So, yeah. I don't know how this Texas news is going to... Well, that's really hard. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence. I mean, that's why you mentioned it just now. It's not a coincidence that there have been so many challenges against specifically trans books the past few months. And this is coming. It's kind of like it was leading here all along in a way.
Yeah.
Not to be too conspiratorial or anything like that. But here we are. And I'm not excited to know what like the next step is. But it is, as you said before, it is a very concerted effort. And, I mean, it's fascism. Can we just go there?
Yeah. It's so interesting to me how many people will be like, oh, this is like, you know, what was happening in Nazi Germany. And they will kind of say that with like this wonder in their voice. Like, can you believe that it's actually happening here? It's so alarming. And it's like, yeah. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Like, let's not just kind of compare it to something in the past, because I think it's really, like you were saying, it's very easy to kind of be like, oh, this is just like something that happened so far in the past. But, you know, that was in the past and we got through it. And it's like, yeah, but like, here we are again. And also, in case you remember, millions of people died as a result of something that started with book burning. So let's not go there. Yeah. So clearly I have strong feelings about that.
As we all do, as you should.
So we're going to talk about some things that I think we can do together. And this is obviously not an exhaustive list. And we're going to try to end with some positive news and some sort of empowering ideas. Mm-hmm. But first, I do have to give you another sponsor. So hang with us. This episode is sponsored by Macmillan Audio and Merritt Weisenberg's The Golden State, read by Audie Award winner Brittany Presley. The Winslow family has 5 rules. No one can know your real name. Don't stay in one place too long. If you sense anything is wrong, go immediately to the meeting spot. Keeping the family together is everything, and we wish we could tell you who we were, but we can't. So when the results of a DNA test Poppy took in secret unravel the truth about her parents' identities, Poppy realizes she's undone decades of cover-up work, and the past is dangerously close to catching up on them. This Golden State is a propulsive breakout audiobook following a family on the run, a restless teenage daughter hungry for the truth, and the simple DNA test that threatens their carefully crafted world. It's read by Audie Award-winning narrator Brittany Presley, whose narrator I personally admire a lot, and Kirkus Reviews calls this Golden State captivating. Thank you so much to Macmillan Audio for sponsoring this episode. All right, so actions, solutions, good news. Mm-hmm. I just have a list here, but we're going to kind of go through and talk and, you know, Erica, you're going to add to things, I'm sure. But I feel like one of the things that tends to get glossed over in this, like, age of, like, write to your senator, speak out, go march, do this, is that, like, really a lot of this stuff happens closer to home or starts closer to home. Mm-hmm. So if you hear friends, family, or acquaintances spreading misinformation, racism, homophobia, transphobia, stop it. Nip it in the bud. Just say something. Mm-hmm. One of the things, my partner's trans, and they have their own sort of stuff that they're going, you know, dealing with at work. And, you know, diversity inclusion is always kind of something that like they get roped into as like the token trans person at work.
Yeah.
But one thing that they like to say a lot is we don't need you to just be an ally. We need you to be an accomplice.
Mm.
And that is, I think, great because an accomplice does things. An accomplice is active, like takes action. Because I think it's so easy for people to be like, oh, I'm an ally because this is what I believe. And it's like, that's great. But like, now we need you to act on that belief. So, I mean, what that looks like is if somebody says something racist, call them out.
Yeah.
If somebody misuses pronouns, you can just gently correct them. Like, it doesn't have to be a whole thing. If somebody is saying something that's wrong or homophobic, say something. And I mean, I admit, like, it's uncomfortable. I don't like being uncomfortable. But, like, you're not doing anybody any good if you just, like, decide to be quietly uncomfortable when somebody says something awful and then, like, you don't say something. Because that other person should be uncomfortable. They're the ones that are saying something that's, you know,
that
wrong
part.
Or racist or homophobic. Yeah.
Like, I feel like a lot of people spend a lot of time making bigots and racists and all those people feel like considering their feelings. They're not considering anyone else's feelings.
Exactly. So that's like, I feel like my starting point right there.
Yeah. I mean, keeping in line with the Nazi Germany comparisons, I know there's this one picture that's like super famous. I forget where it is, but it was at the height of that. And it's like a picture of all these people doing the salute. And there's one guy in the picture who's not, and he looks like he's disapproving. And it was like, I believe the story was that he was dating a Jewish woman or something like that. But in so many instances, not saying anything is kind of a sign of acceptance or acquiescence, I feel.
Complicity.
Yeah, complicity. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you, Tears. I was like, what is it? I was in the A range, but I needed to go to C's. It's a sign of being complicit. And it signals, if you don't say anything, it signals to the person who said the offensive thing that you kind of agree with them, that they're right in saying that. And anyone else around them who hears it, they're going to feel like that you both agree on that. Kids who are around, it kind of helps to teach them that, like, okay, this is, like, you know, the way to be, especially if you're an adult. If you're adults, you're modeling that behavior. So I like that you mentioned that as a first step, because I don't think people take that step as seriously as they should, because that's where a lot of it starts. And it's like, if you're just in an echo chamber, well, an echo chamber is like having those thoughts echoed back to you. But I think complicity is not too far from outright saying, like, oh, I agree with you and saying that trans people should not XYZ or Black people should not, you know, this, that, and the third. Yeah. So I really like that you said that. I think that people are so, again, scared of being uncomfortable, wanting to be comfortable, and not realizing that always being comfortable and being able to make sure that they feel comfortable by avoiding these uncomfortable topics is a sign of privilege. And like you said before, it's no one's blaming you for being privileged. No one is trying to fight you for it. It's just like, just acknowledge that that is the case and then move on to see, like, you know, what you can do to help remedy the situation. Because like I said, if you're, like we've been saying, if you're, you know, a person of color or trans or queer, you're already uncomfortable. you're if you heard that offensive statement that the person said and you belong to one of those groups, you're going to be super duper uncomfortable. So just think about that when, you know, it comes time to speak out against something.
Absolutely. So my next points, I think, you know, they're more on the whole thing of, obviously, a lot of these challenges are coming from a place of like mass organization. So we just have to respond with more mass organization. And I think if you're a teacher or a librarian and you're listening to this, you're probably already on top of this. But if you're not, like, know your acquisition policies. Like, if you don't have clear, specific acquisition policies, now is the time to set them. Now is the time to revisit them to make sure that they're up to date and that they're clear. I think at this point, I was chatting with a friend who sits on the library board in another town, and she's just like, for us, it's not a matter of like if we get a challenge. It's when we're waiting for it. Like, we are anticipating it. And I do feel like that is how a lot of people do feel. Like, I was reading an article in my local paper last week where the library director was saying, like, you know, we haven't had any challenges yet, but like, this is our stance on them. And I do appreciate that they are kind of getting out the information that, like, look, this is not who we are. Like, if you challenge a book, we're not just going to be like, oh, okay, and pull it off the shelf. Like, now is the time to be very clear about where you stand. Yeah, so if you're a teacher or librarian, make sure that your policies are up to date and clear, because your policies will, you know, guide you. If we want the system to work as it's supposed to, like, we have to have clear policies that we can, you know, support and point to. So to that point, if you're not a teacher or a librarian, there are still ways that you can get involved as a reader and as a citizen. Consider sitting on your library board. I feel like this is a thing that, like, a lot of readers don't, like, stop and consider as a possibility. I have a really great post on Book Riot about, like, the why and how of, like, why you should sit on your library board. There's a link in the show notes. But, you know, every public library is governed by, like, a board, or, you know, board of trustees, however they call it. It's basically, you know, essentially the same thing, which is, like, a board of citizens gets to determine how the library is run and who hires the director. And they work with the director, and usually with a governing body like a city or a county, depending on what sort of library you have set up, to set these policies and to deal with challenges. So, like, if you are concerned about challenges being, you know, addressed in your library board, go sit on your library board. Go sit on your school board. I don't know as much about sitting on a local school board. I don't have children. I just don't know as much about how that works. But, like, go figure it out. And finally, like, if you can't sit on these boards, which is completely understandable, because unfortunately, a lot of time and effort and, like, unpaid labor goes into doing this. And it's not always suitable for people who work full time. Like, a lot of times, like, board meetings will be in the middle of the afternoon or something like that. And that's really obnoxious. However, even if you can't, like, actually go sit on a board, read the minutes of, like, the board meeting minutes. So those minutes must be published publicly. Like, by law, they have to be posted publicly. So, you know, if you can't find them, ask for them. If nobody's willing to give them to you, make a fuss, because they should. But the reason for this is, like, it's important to know what's going on. It's important to know what issues are being discussed, because sometimes there are issues of censorship that you can find in minutes that might not make it to local news, or there are things that are happening that you're like, I don't agree with that. Well, even if you don't sit on a board, you still have power. You can show up to meetings. If you can't show up to meetings, you can write a letter to the board. Like, these board members are supposed to represent the people. Mm-hmm. So make your voice heard. Know what's going on. And, you know, even if the issues in question aren't about censorship, like, you should still know what's going on. I think one really telling article that we're going to link here was one that Kelly wrote, and she wrote about how these challenges were going through this board, and so many people showed up for the meeting where they were going to discuss whether or not to keep the books. And then as soon as they decided, okay, we're going to keep the books, the meeting wasn't over. Like, 90% of the audience left.
Oh, my God.
They were like, okay, cool. So, like, they didn't care to know, like, what else was going on. Mm-hmm. And, like, that is a problem as well. That's not one that we'll get into right now. But, like, but those are, like, some, I think, really actionable things that, you know, you should just know about. Like, mm-hmm. read your local paper. Read your local library minutes. Know what's going on in your community.
I feel like, and I might just might be the exception, I feel like a lot of, I don't hear much about local news from, like, peers and stuff like that. I don't know if that's just my friends or our generation at large. I'm not sure. I do hear, you know, talk of, like, national and world news, but I do think that I, for one, and people I speak to on a regular basis could definitely benefit from reading local news more.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue is that, like, a lot of us don't subscribe to newspapers at the local level.
Yeah.
And, like, that is just, like, a cultural shift, especially with our generation, like, the millennials. But we are on social media all the time. And, like, Twitter will show us world headlines and state headlines to a certain extent. And you'll see things pop up on Instagram or on Facebook. Like, those world headlines, like, they tend to grab more attention, so we'll talk about those. But, like, unless you make a concerted effort to go out of your way and know what's going on in your local community, you don't know what's going on. And I think that, like, my challenge to anybody who is not especially, like, keyed into their local news, especially if you live in, like, a small town, go to your local newspaper's website and see how much it is just for a digital subscription. Like, I subscribe to one of my local papers, because I live in a small town, but we're lucky enough to have two papers. One of my local papers I subscribe to for $4 a month, and the other for, like, $10 a month. So for the cost of a Netflix subscription, I have two local newspapers that sometimes, yes, do show overlapping news stories, but I have two local newspapers that, like, I get, you know, access to. And I do have to make time out of my day to remember to, like, go check and read the paper or, you know, read the website. But it's important because that's how you find out about these things, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I think it's, like, a cultural shift, a generational shift. And I think it is important, as you're saying, to be more proactive in doing that, because a lot of times I think, like, we're starting to fight against these instances of attempted censorship and book bans once they've already got steam, you know, because they've been going on for a while. Kelly also has a really helpful anti-censorship toolkit. We'll leave that in the links as well. And she mentions how, you know, also talking to your newspaper, like writing, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, Tirza, like, don't be afraid to write to people. Talk about the library, hype it up, talk about the importance of it. Also talk about things that you're seeing that you don't care for at the library, maybe. Like, if you feel like your library is an undergoing censorship, like, through the school board, just, you know, be in communication with them. And also submitting materials requests for books by authors of color and queer authors. Show that those books are wanted by people in the community, i.e. you.
And check them out.
check them out. Yeah, just go just check them out. Even if you don't finish it, just check them out.
Yeah, and it's so weird to me because, like, I used to work in collection development, and I would talk to patrons, and they would, like, we talk about books, and they'd be like, oh, you know, I don't, maybe you get that book in, but maybe not. And I'd be like, tell me what book you want, because it is literally my job to buy what the community wants. Yeah. And, like, obviously every library is going to have their own collection development policy, but our policy was that, like, we prioritize what the community requests.
Yeah.
So don't feel like you're making this big ask or you're putting anybody out by requesting books that you actually want to check out and read. Like, that is literally what your tax dollars should be funding.
Yeah. There are I don't know. I'm guessing that, well, based on what you just said, like, say if someone had, like, an interlibrary loan request, you would, like, then consider ordering that book for your regular collection, right? Just as an example.
Yeah, as an example, like, you know, sometimes, like, one request doesn't always, like, float to, like, the surface. But, like, yeah, if I used to look at this report that would, like, give us every single interlibrary loan request in the month. And we could, like, rank the report by, like, how many times a book was requested, like, a certain book. So, like, the top books, like, what are the top books that are being requested? Is it a book that we don't have? And, like, eight people requested it in a month. Like, that means that I should probably get it.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. But I think also, like, yeah, submitting, like, purchase requests and talking to your librarians, too, about, like, what you want. And just saying, like, oh, I really like novels, like, horror novels by people of color. Like, it'd be cool to see more of those in. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if librarians are doing their job, like, they will hopefully get that in because they can say, oh, but this patron asked for that. This patron said that they wanted to check this out. So I think that's, like, a really easy and, like, low-cost way of supporting diverse collections.
And I would even say, too, to make sure you, like, email them. So then there's, like, a record of it. You know what I mean? Just an extra tip.
A lot of people, or a lot of libraries have, like, if you have a library card with them, if you go to their website, then you realize that you have an account on their, like, online database. Mm-hmm. And it depends on, you know, what system your libraries use. But, like, my library has this really cool system called Apollo Biblionics, and it's really easy to use. I've, like, used it as a librarian, but, like, now also as a patron. And it's, like, you put in your library card number and a password that you set up with the library, and you can see everything, and, like, you can actually submit purchase requests right through that. So sometimes you don't even have to talk to people or really go out of your way. You literally just, like, fill out a form on your library website.
That sounds really nice. I'm not sure if my library has that, but I'll definitely look into it. I mean, I do wear out that app, I will say.
I love Libby and all that.
Yes. So I'll definitely have to look to see if that is there. And also in the interest of staying up to date on things like this, mentioning Kelly again, she does do a weekly roundup of censorship news on Book Riot. So, you know, definitely check that out every Friday. And I would also recommend, I actually wrote an article for them, but Anti-Racism Daily does a newsletter, and it's usually, like, a short read. And even if you can't, I like the structure that they have for their newsletter sends. Even if you can't dedicate time to reading the entire thing, a lot of times they offer summaries, like, usually kind of towards the bottom, so you can get the bullet points and just kind of have basic knowledge of what's going on. And it's called Anti-Racism Daily. Obviously, they cover racism. They cover everything, though. Racism, homophobia, education, discrimination, housing discrimination, all that stuff. So I think that is an excellent way to just stay informed. And sometimes it's, as we've said, you know, throughout this episode, it can be surprising to see, like, what is going on that you would not have known had you not been going out of your way to see it.
Absolutely. Oh, these are all such great resources. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think, you know, we very pointedly are leaving for last, like, obviously read banned books. I think sometimes that gets, like, tossed around as like the cure.
Yeah.
But the point is that when books are censored, they're challenged and they're pulled from libraries, people can't read them. You know, there are kids and teens who then do, like, they lose access. They no longer have any access despite lots of efforts to donate books and really try to connect kids with books. What we're seeing right now is kind of just, like, this absolute avalanche of challenges. And there's no possible way for everybody to, you know, donate hundreds of books that are being pulled from shelves to all the kids who want to read them, because so many of them rely on being able to be in the library and check out books then. So reading banned books is absolutely important, and I don't want to, like, diminish that. And I do think that, like, if you're going to donate banned books to organizations or put them in little free libraries, please do continue to do that. But, like, don't let that be the only thing you do.
It's really, like you said, putting a Band-Aid on the problem, because, okay, you read those particular banned books and you buy them for X amount of libraries, then the people who are fighting them and censoring them in the first place are just going to come up with new books that they ban. So it's like,
exactly. Yeah. Fight the system, not, you know, the writer and reader in me doesn't want to be like, don't just flood them with books, but, like,
right.
You know, that, like, yes, like, don't just do that, but, like, keep doing that, but also, you know, understand that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes, and there's, you know, a lot of organization and insidious intent behind all of this. So hopefully if you understand that, you will be better equipped to fight against it in small and big ways. And yeah, we hope you take a look at a lot of these resources and kind of come up with your own plan. Like, my hope would be that everybody listening to this would figure out, like, at least one piece of action that they can do, mm-hmm. like, this week, from what we've talked about. and stick with it, please. And obviously, let us know if you do take action. You can find us on social media. But probably the best way to get a hold of us is emailing us at heyya@bookriot.com. And that, that's a great way to get a hold of us. And we'd love to hear what you are doing. And if you have other ideas, we'd love to hear that too.
Yeah, definitely. Other charities or just other creative ways of getting involved and staying involved that other people can do.
Yes. All right. We could go on and on, but yeah. I think we need to wrap it up. So thank you so much for tuning in this week. You can always leave us feedback about the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify to let us know how we're doing. That also helps others find us and email us, of course. Again, our email address is heyya@bookriot.com. And don't forget to visit bookriot.com for newsletters, more podcasts, and all things bookish. Thanks again to today's sponsors for helping make the show possible. And thanks as always to our awesome audio editor, Jen Zink. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I hang out at, it's at Tears of Price. It's TIRZAHPRICE. And Erica, how about you?
I am occasionally on Twitter at @Erica_EZE_. So that's @ERICA_EZE_.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for hanging out with us, even though it was quite a heavy topic and we got a little bit spicy.
A little spicy.
We will be back again in 2 weeks.